Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People. The Ojibwe people of Minnesota have a wealth of stories to tell. Stories of life, of death, of family, of ceremony, of culture, of history, both oral and written. Of migration, of treaties and broken treaties, of legend and spirits, and much more. Most of all, the story of the Anishinaabe, the Ojibwe people, is one of life and a determination to survive. Larry Aiken lives in Cass Lake, just down the road from the Leech Lake Tribal College. In fact, Larry used to be president of the Tribal College, its first ever president. He also used to be a tenured professor at University of Minnesota, Duluth. Now he is a professor at Itasca Community College in Grand Rapids. He's a well-known and influential teacher and spiritual advisor in northern Minnesota, well-known among Native and non-Native people alike. Larry Aiken.
I used to be identified as the most single eligible bachelor in Ojibwe country for 20 years, but I got married in 1988, 25 years ago, so I'm no longer that. But you can identify me. I always identify myself as an Ojibwe man from Leech Lake. And I'm a father, a brother, and a son. And for 18 and a half years, I was Oshkabewis, a go-between, a helper, a pipe carrier, and an interpreter for a medicine man by the name of Jim Jackson, Gate Tabuan. He had three Indian names, and for 18 and a half years, we traversed the earth together and went among our people, and wherever we were needed, we went, and every other week, we'd go into five major prisons in Minnesota and talk to the brothers behind bars and say, you know, they may lock your body up, but they didn't lock your spirit up, and what you did, you can now recover from. And if you're sincere enough, you'll walk free again, no matter what you did. And there was a man that said to Jim Jackson, he said, "No, Jimmy, you'll never free me. I got life." And Jimmy said, "I don't understand that word never. I don't understand the word always. It seemed like permanent words." Well, he said, "I got life." And Jimmy said, "If you're sincere and you stick with me, I can get you out of here, walk free." He said, "No, I got life, Jimmy." Jimmy said, "Did you hear me? I can get you out. But you have to pledge after you're with me to walk free and straight again when you get out." And the guy said, "Well, sure, I pledge." "No," Jimmy said, "you can't do it that quick. We'll work with you. And we'll bring you to a sweat lodge, and we'll talk with you about the language, about the culture, and why you're here. And 100% of the natives that are in this place are here because of the brown bottle, one way, shape, or form. 100%. But he said, "I'm affected too, and I don't drink, and Larry Aiken, he's affected too, he don't drink. But we're all 100% affected as Native people about alcohol. We're all affected. That doesn't mean we're prone or we're weak to alcohol. That means there's a perception of Indians and alcohol, and you live that perception." He said, "So if you want to be free, you got to let go of that. You got to quit living your life for other people. Alcohol lives on the approval of other people. That's why you drink. That's why you drink, and that's why you're here. If you let that go and stay with us, we'll help you out." And he said, "I'll bet you in less than 6 months, you'll be out." The guy said, "I don't believe." "Well," he said, "then you're not going to get out if you don't believe. As anything on spirituality or religion, it's all on belief. How much you believe and what you believe and how you're connected to that." 6 months later, Commissioner Moot told Jim Jackson that this man is free based on Jim's recommendation, and he walked out. He's still free, and he's still straight, and he's still healthy, too.
Larry has some pretty strong thoughts on what that represents.
Those, to me, are miracles, you know. But everyday miracles happen when somebody helps somebody else get out of prison and they choose to go straight in their life. Now, that's a miracle. Common everyday people helping everyday people, that's a miracle. When the weak help the strong or the poor help the wealthy, those are miracles. I mean, splitting the Red Sea, a ball of fire, yeah, we can make those happen on television. But in reality, our magic is all around here. And that's part of us, part of spirituality.
Larry Akin talks about his first days with Jim Jackson back in the early 70s.
When I first walked through the old man, he asked me if I believed. He said, I'm a medicine man. Do you believe me? Yeah, I said, I heard about you. No, he said, you said that too quick. He said, do you believe what I can do? Well, I heard you can cure cancer. Yeah. And heart disease, he said, yeah. And take gallstones out of people without ever cutting them and have them in a bowl and you're done. I can do that. One of these days, he said, I'll show you. So you'll understand, I'm not just a man. I'm given special gifts to help other people. Because without spirits, without the invisible force, I'm nothing. I'm just an old man. He said, do you understand? I said, yes. Aha, he said. Well, one day it came to pass. The old boy came over and it's against his belief system. Called me up and said, come over to my house. He said, I got something to show you tonight. All right. And I was only with him about maybe a year and a half. The little boy swallowed a screw. And he couldn't poop it out. He couldn't throw it up. And that screw, they took a shot of it, x-ray. And he had the x-ray with him, and he showed Jimmy. and his grandma brought him over and said, I want you to pray for him. And Jimmy said, what do you mean, pray for him? Well, look, she said, that's a screw he swallowed. And he said, he can't poop it out, and he can't throw it up. Stuck in here. And in a couple of days' time, the white doctors are going to open them up, cut them up, and take the screw out. And I don't want that to happen, she said. Jimmy said, well, what do you want me to do? Can you pray for him? I can do that. But you want me to do more than that, don't you? Can you see if you can help him? Jimmy said, yeah. Bring him back, Larry. So I went in the back room and laid him down, little boy there, and Jimmy did a ceremony, and I darkened the room and put his ear to the clink, and that dish was that little screw. And he turned the light on again, here you go. And go get your x-ray, and the guy went outside, held it up to the x-ray. Yeah, I think that's the same one. He said, here you go. Go give that to your grandma, he said. He went around and said, Grandma, look, he said. The grandma looked at that screw and she looked at Jimmy and said, oh, watch your mommy, your mom. She started crying. Gago, mama can. He said, don't cry. Oh, no, yeah, I need to go. He said, that's not me. Get your money, ma. And the way in the market came, that's what we do, cover shit. It's not me, he said, the Creator. And the Creator put spirits here on this earth to help. And he said, I'm in touch with them. And the spirits doctored him, not me. Whenever I doctor for cancer, I don't do it. He said, the spirits do it. I just know them by name, and I ask them to come in. It's all done in ceremony way, Indian language, Ojibwe language. And if I ever had any doubts after that night, I didn't ever doubt him. That's the way it was, and I see him doctor people with cancer. And he darkened the room again, and he closed his eyes, a blue light would come out, and the blue light would go all through the body, and then kind of, when he found the cancer, it would kind of glow above that illness, that sickness, that disease. And Jimmy would say, okay, now we want that out. Great, Jimmy. And he'd swallow the bones, and they'd take it out of him through the bones and out. And then Jimmy regurgitate that into a bowl, and here comes the cancer. And he did that for many, many, many years. And I begged him to stop doing it because he was getting old and weak, and some of the residuals of cancer would stay in him. And as you do that for that many years, he was a cancer doctor. That's what he was noted for. And he kept taking cancer out of people, but I have to go through him to get out. And some residuals would stay in. And he had always enough strength to get rid of them, you know. But later on in life, he got older, and we all begged him, stop now. It's time to quit. Yeah, next time, he said, no more. I'm going to quit doing that, he said. Somebody come with a hard luck story, and he do one more.
Ojibwe medicine man Jim Jackson died on April 19, 1992. And you have to wonder, is there anyone around like him anymore? I put that question to Larry Aitken.
Sure, there's enough people around that have acquired that doctoral, medicinal, spiritual power to do that, sure. And there are people that have it that don't even know they have it. And in fact, I had a guy sitting in this room about a month and a half before Jimmy died. He was interviewing me, and I said, whatever you do, I'm not a medicine man. I'm just a one-eyed professor trying to make a living like anyone else. And I know you guys didn't know I had one eye, but there's one eye. It's kind of shocking, guys, a little bit. Anyway, I told him, I'm just a one-eyed professor trying to make a living here. You know, I'm nothing. And he said, well, if Jimmy should die, all he taught you, then you would be heir apparent. I said, no. Well, who's going to be? I don't know. I said, I may get the calling. I may not. And I said, it's not up to you or me or any human. It's up to the spirits. And there's a medicine man that I know. He's a real good friend of mine. He thinks I'm in denial. You know, and he said, Larry, he said, if you're not a medicine man, you're the closest thing to it. And I said, no, don't put that on me. Because Jim Jackson told me, don't ever wish to be that. Your life changes so much. And your life is not yours anymore. You belong to the people. And whenever they call, whenever they have need, you do that. I know I'm close to that now because a lot of people call me to do things. And I can do most anything that was taught, you know, and but I don't wish to be a medicine man. There's no notoriety, and people doubt you, and you get ridiculed, and you know, backstabbed, and a lot of stuff goes on about people that have that kind of power. And so I wouldn't wish that. He said, don't wish to be a medicine man. He said, don't want that. He said, because it's not an easy life. And so, not for that reason, but. And I have had plenty of dreams, you know, and the dreams are predicated on what you're going to be in the future and what you know in the past and what you could know. I know that. And I'm a prolific dreamer, and I sort of, my place where I dream, you know, and it's a special place, and I don't need anybody to bother me. I go to sleep there, and I dream about a name. I dream about a ceremony, dream about something, and then it comes out that way, you know. So I already have a tremendous amount of responsibility. But I want to let you know something right now. Being an Indian is not a privilege. It's a responsibility. Every Indian is responsible for the rest of the world and the way it is. Every day you're supposed to get up and pray for the good of the order. All of humanity, all the sick, all the hateful, all the ignorant, all the fools, pray for them all. Don't leave anybody out. You're always supposed to pray for the good of the order, and that's what I do. And, you know, somebody out there prays for you. I have a lot of people that I named, and some people that I married, and some people adopted. They all pray for me. I know that. And at my wedding, when I got married, I showed you my wedding picture. There were 300 people there. And Jim Jackson told those people there, you're not here observing. For the rest of your life, from now on, you pray for Larry and Polly that their marriage is solid and will be a good, strong, healthy marriage. You pray with them every day. That's your job. And their job is they'll give you gifts before you leave. And that's the way marriages go. White man, you go to a white man wedding and you get toasters and you get towels and you get all these things, you know, that's nice. But when you get married as a native person, you give gifts to the people that come there because they're going to pray for you. And that's the way it works.
Larry and his wife Polly have been married for 25 years. And he talked about what the two of them promised back when they married, promised to each other, and promised to their community of family and friends.
Roger Jourdain is still alive. And he said, I think I'm the only one. Of course, Roger would say that whether he wasn't or not. Because Roger is a pretty strong personality. And a great friend of mine and a great friend of the medicine man, Jim Jackson. And so he was at our wedding and he said, I'm going to speak here because I'm the oldest Ojibwe here. In fact, he said, I think I'm older than your medicine man by a year. And I think he was, too. Whether or not he was or not, he was going to speak anyway. So he spoke and he talked about nobody doing this anymore. He said, everybody's ashamed of being native. Nobody wants to come out in public and say, I want to pledge a life partner for the rest of my life. Never marry, never divorce, never fall out of love, ever. Nobody wants to do that anymore. Everybody wants to have partners two or three times a year, two or three times in their lifetime. This man is strong, he said, Jim Jackson. And he's right, marrying these two. They're marrying for life today. And they will forsake all partners. Like the eagle, you mate for life. That's what they're going to do. Nobody does that anymore. So I'm really happy that this man did this. He was really a really good speaker. He wasn't our chosen speaker. He just took it upon himself to say, this is what I'm going to do. I'm the oldest Ojibwe here, and I have a right to say. And he did. And he spoke loud and clear to everybody there. And all you white people watching this, he said, you look at this, he said, these people will be role models for you. Now you think, oh boy, you know. And we are. Polly and I have been married 25 years. And three beautiful children, all girls that I prayed for, because I wouldn't wish a boy on anybody. And my mother had five boys, and I said, oh, boy, you know. When I got married, I said, I hope we have girls. In fact, I think I'll pray for girls. And I did, and I was graciously granted that. So I have three beautiful daughters, and they turned out just like I hope they would, you know. And they never leave home. They all went to college. They're going to college now. And if you love them just enough, they'll never leave home. And to me, that's what spirituality is about. It's the spirit of the family and what we stand for. They have never been inside a church, ever. And they know God to greater dimensions than most Christians. Because every single day they pray and they talk to God. Every time something happens in our family, somebody dies, somebody gets hurt, they talk to God. Gichimoniyu, Wakantanka, Deus. We have all these names for God. But my family is not religious, but we're very spiritual. And we use tobacco every day. My 9-year-old, when we go to take her to school every morning, I reach in the back seat and give her tobacco. And I say, oh, you want to start the prayer, honey? And she'd say, sure. Kwe gishimani dugu sanana zapanano se ma bagijigan gagijman. Kwe kusadud gigijawin. That's all I know, Father. And okay, that's good enough. And then I go on from there. And that's the way I started the rest of my girls. They all started. And now they can say anything. And you ask my 9-year-old, how do you say Saturday? Which is one of the hardest words to say in the Ojibwe language. You'd say, Saturday, gizibi gisaganagay gijigad. Just like that. You know, because she lives with the language. And she's not afraid to use the language. And they all have spirit names. And they live a spiritual life. That is what spirituality is about. We're all connected to the total universe and to all humans. That's why we're responsible for everybody. So being an Indian is not a privilege. It's a responsibility. And they know it. And if somebody hurts you or discriminates against you, love them. Pray hard for them. And maybe it'll change. Maybe it won't. But you won't be like them if you do that. And I taught them that. And that's what I was taught. And so that is spirituality in the Indian way.
Larry Aiken has had a busy life as a medicine man's helper, as an educator and administrator, and as a father.
We do the best we can with what we have. We're thankful every day for what we have. And they know their father will one day walk to the spirit world. They know that. And we talk about it. But most families don't talk about stuff like that. Oh, that'll never happen. It's going to happen to all of us. You know? I mean, we don't think it's going to happen. I mean, but when it does, we accept it, you know. And it takes a little more accepting sometimes because we realize our own inevitability is at hand too. And we'll go there too one day. Well, I'm not ready to go. I got stuff to do yet. And they know that. But they know their father won't be around forever. And I used to always think when my mother and Jim Jackson said, "We're not going to be around forever. Listen." I didn't believe that. I always thought they'd be around forever. Spiritually, they are. Their lessons and the things they taught us, the principles, the values, sure they live on. They're legacies. We live by those. And they're still with us. We just can't kiss them and hug them, that's all. And I know that my mom and Andy and Jim Jackson and all the people that are my true friends, I'll meet them again. That's why we never say goodbye. We only say, "Gagawabamin." I'll see you later. And hopefully later is not tomorrow because I got things to do yet. But if it is tomorrow, I want you to know this. Every day is a good day to die for Indians. That means you have forgiven all those that forsake you. You have forgiven yourselves for being weak. And you have forgiven those that transgressed against you. And you forgive yourself for transgressing against people. And if God takes you tonight, get ready. And ask people, how many of you are ready? Oh, no, I'm not ready to go yet because my uncle and I are not seeing eye to eye and I still got bad feelings toward my aunt and my sister and I don't. Well, what are you going to say if God calls you now? Every day is a good day to die. You ought to be ready to go every day because one of these days you're going to be right. Life is not easy. Life is a struggle. But the color of your character is how you meet that struggle. And they know that. And that, to me, that's the most important lesson you teach your children. That when you meet struggle, get up to it and do it. Because it's going to happen, whether you're up to it or not. So be ready. Be prepared. And they are. And so my whole life is preparing them to be adults. To be good adults, to be good, healthy native citizens and understand and love their people with all their faults. I mean, we have a lot of faults in Indian country, but love them all because I don't know who to leave out. And if I was one of the ones that were left out, I wouldn't feel very good. In the end, get your money due. We'll take all native people and put them behind them and judge the rest on what you did to these. Because when the new people came here, we offered them everything. And they did things to us. And we said, don't hate the white man for that. In time, they will pay for what happened. Not by your hand. You live a good life and be happy. Don't worry about that. Like an infested sore, if you keep tearing off that scab, it's going to keep being sore. Let it go and you know, and scar over. And you remember the scar, but the hurt is gone. The sting of the pain is gone. And don't defend yourself or your people. And don't take things personal. When you see a dumb, drunken Indian, well, I'm not dumb. I'm not drunk. I am native. I'm not even Indian. I guess I would call myself Ojibwe. Or in the Indian way, Anishinaabe, which means spontaneous humans. We're all Anishinaabe. But specifically, we're Ojibwe. And for that, I say, you know, it's about time we looked at life that way. We look at so much adverse things in our world, things that separate us, not things that keep us together. And I want you to know that all the things that happened to Indian people by white people's hands, I forgave them. Because I don't want to live that legacy of hate and anger and bitterness and personal default. because when you default, you all pull the Indian cards. Ah, oh, they don't like me because the Indian. I can't success because can't be a success because I'm an Indian. That's a default thing, and that's an easy thing to pull, and probably even right in a lot of ways. But still, that holds you back from doing what you need to do, because you all have the energy and the strength to live right. We call it Bhimadasi Win, the good life. The life that the Creator intended for all of us to live. And be happy, you know. There's enough sadness and irritability and negativity going on in the world. If you can have that happiness just in there on your supper table at night, your family, your children will live a good life and they'll understand this is where life will always be at this table. I may not understand the world or the school or even the town, but around this table, this is home. And people listen to me, people love me, I can espouse what I believe, or I can tell people what I don't like, but this is home. And if you want to have successful children, I have the remedy. Have supper with them every night, so that they have a place to go, and they have a place to call home. Every night you have supper with your children. Sure, you can buy them a computer, and you can buy them iMac, and you can buy them all these expensive gadgets to make you smarter. But you'll never, ever get away from that home around the table where I feel like I belong. I feel like somebody loves me, somebody listened to me, and I feel spiritually connected to this family unit. And I think that's what we're sorely missing in this country. We're trying to fix everything and not fix ourselves. You know, people will fix their families first. The rest of the world will kind of self-fix itself. You know, we'd all be connected as family then. So that's part of what I'm trying to get across to my people.
You are listening to Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People.
I've always taught in my philosophy class and to my people, when I sit around with youth groups in the summertime or go to camp, the human makeup, we are physical, spiritual, and, you know, we got it all wrong. People say in the 80s, everybody became with it, body, mind, and spirit, holistic. And the old man said to me, you know what? Those white people are getting close. It is body, mind, and spirit, only it's in reverse. It's spirit, mind, and body. Because your spirit is huge. And then the next big circle is your mind. And the smallest part is your body. You're more spiritual than you are mind, and more mind than you are body. The smallest part of us is body. But we always take care of our body first. You ought to get up in the morning and put tobacco in your hand or Bible or however you, you know, become spiritual and thank God for this world and this earth and this life and this day. And so if you take care of the spirit, it'll take care of the mind, it'll take care of the body in that way. And spirituality is a sense that we have this, the four upper worlds are, we look up in the nighttime sky and you see billions of stars. Well, they're not stars. They're spirits and souls of those that are born and yet to be born, and those that died and went back to the spirit world. So we know where the spirit world is. We know what it is. And we know how we got here. We came from the spirit world to be here. And above that big galaxy of spirits, the next upper world is the sun and the moon world, and that controls the seasons and the cycles and the tides and the low tides, you know. And Father Sun and Grandmother Moon control those cycles. And you look at that, the first upper world of all is God's world, Gichimonizu, Wekantanka, however you call the all container. That's the first upper world. In the second upper world, then he created all these billions of souls and spirits, which are the star world, and of the born and unborn. And the third upper world then is that sun and the moon world. And the fourth upper world is the earth world. But on the earth world, it created children. And the first child God created was the soil, the mountains, the flesh of the earth. And the second put beings that were grass, flowers, and trees. Those are the spirit beings on top of the earth. And then they call it the animal kingdom, but it includes the insects and the birds and the fish. Created those three orders first. The covering, the green things, and then the fishes and the animal beings. And they're all beings, because they're all alive. And the last, he said, you know, and this is all coming out in the Birchbark Scrolls of our people in Grand Medicine. They said, you know, I look at everything and it's so beautiful, but who's going to sing the songs and hear the songs of the birds? And who's going to pray for that this magical kingdom that God created works? And God created humans, the two-legged, the fourth order of the earth, to appreciate and to pray and to keep things together. And he gave them to know the life and life cycle of all the things of the earth. Not to be above it, but to live in harmony with it. We're not over the earth. We don't have dominion over the earth. We are to live in harmony with it. And if we live in harmony with it, it will improve our life. And water, the trees, all these things, they have life too. Think of it, a sequoia tree has a lifespan of 150 years. And you have a lifespan of 100 years. And you can't lengthen that lifespan. You're given, when you're born, you're given a handful of days to live. It's 100 years. And you can't lengthen that, but you can shorten it on the way you live and the way you treat other people. Your choice.
Larry Akin is a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, an elder, a teacher, and he possesses a lot of knowledge. Traditional native spirituality has many things in common with all spirituality, whatever your particular religion is or is not, and it has many beliefs that are very different, or perhaps more in focus. We asked him to talk about that, and Larry told us a wonderful story.
Part of this life, we are given special qualities and gifts and benefits being human. And the number one is free will. We make choice. Birds fly south, they don't make choices by instinct. They dig a hole and they burrow and they get ready for winter. That's instinct. We have free choice. We don't have to get ready for winter. And a lot of us don't. And then we find ourselves after it snowed, oh, my snow tires aren't on, or I didn't do this. Well, you're supposed to prepare. And if you look at all around you, if you watch the bear get ready and get ready for hibernation, and you watch the little animals get ready for hibernation, and you walk and see the geese flying south, you know, they're telling us, winter's coming, time to get ready. They're telling us these things, but we don't listen to that because we're free will. We don't have to listen to anybody, and generally we don't. And we used to watch the whole being of the whole universe of the being. We used to watch it and live by it and hear it and smell it and feel it. And it would tell us things and what we're supposed to do. We don't listen anymore. We do what we want to do. And we create this artificial intelligence that tell us, you're more happy if you do this. No, you're not. You're more happy if you walk in the water. You're more happy if you take sage and sweetgrass in your hand, you burn it, and you smell it. You're happier. And not by turning on a computer. That's fun and important, but what does that do for you? You turn it off again, it's gone. But if you take cedar in your hand and crush it down and smell it, and it's good for you, it's good for your soul, it's good for your inside, and it does things for you. That's why smelling, sight, and hearing is important. And we used to get that strength from the universe. And now artificial intelligence, we're getting further and further away from the earth. And then further and further about treating and mistreating each other too. There's no spiritual connection anymore. And of the four orders of the earth, of the four upper worlds, we're all connected. because of two things. Number one, we have the same creator, God, Kichiwanijo, Wekan Tonka. And number two, we all have the gift of life called a soul. That's what a being is. We are all those things. A tree, a flower, a rock. Oh, rock, hey, wait a minute now. I believe a tree and a flower lives, but a rock, I don't get that rock. Really? Well, I was saying this one time when I was teaching at the University of Minnesota Duluth about rocks. And the medical profession are so scientific and so non-spiritual. They said, you know, we like the trees and we like the water. And we like the air and the rain and even the snow. But don't tell me rocks live. I mean, that's way too much of my imagination. I said, so you don't think rocks are worthy of your respect? I tell you the story. Rocks live and they have spirit and they have power. And if you take a rock and you heat it up to so many degrees and you put it in a hole called the soul of the mother, heart of the mother in the earth, and you build a fire in that hole and you heat that rock up to red hot and then pretty soon white hot, it gives you strength out. And heat is its strength and it makes you sweat. And all the carcinogens come out of your body by that rock giving its life for you. That's number one, rock does. But more importantly, here's the story I told that little scientist over there at UMD. And he didn't like me anyway because he was from Wisconsin and Indians and whites were in a big battle between fishing rights, I think, at the time. And they said, you're going to have 10 hours from this Indian man who is going to talk to you about being a doctor. And, you know, boy, I walked in, I could just feel it and sense it. We don't want him here. And so my first story was the rock story. And I said, I'll tell you a story about rocks, why rocks live. And I go, oh boy, I could see people looking down. Here we go. You know, I said, no, years ago, I said, I know you guys are predicated on scientific knowledge and so forth. So I want you to understand this story. A true story. I said, years ago, this man contracted stomach cancer. About in the 1918s, 1920s. He had stomach cancer. And he went to the white doctor, the Indian Health Service, and the white doctor said, we don't understand what this is. We know it's a disease. I think it's cancer. And you know what? You have stomach cancer. There's no cure for it. You're going to die. He said, well, I guess you won't mind then if I go to a medicine man. How do you go to whoever? You're going to die. You got cancer. There's no cure for it. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to go to a medicine man. So he left the hospital. He went out to the Indian village and he asked the medicine man, Chakuzimami in Jana. He said, I'm sick inside. Ah, be in the game. Come on. They're going to be in the good. Same on. Give me some tobacco. So the guy gave him tobacco. Sit down, he said. Sat down. He said, what's wrong with you? And I asked him, Ojibwe. And he said, I'm sick in here. And I got a disease that a white man doctor didn't know anything about. And they said, I'm going to die. This Indian doctor said, okay. Sleep overnight with me here in the lodge. I want to talk to you. And so he burned Nukwezigun, sage, sweetgrass, and cedar. That's an enhancement toward your senses of smell. And he put him in a euphoric state, and he talked to him about healing and how strong the body is. And he said, I'm going to go into the mountains tomorrow, and I'll get some medicine for you. And so his helpers here in the lodge said, he said, keep him warm. He said, he's going to pass out pretty soon. He'll lose consciousness. So keep him warm until I get back. So after this old Indian man goes into the mountain. And he came back 2 days later and he had a big rock. And he walked inside the lodge and he put that rock on the man, tied it tight around him with buckskin. And he began to sing and pray and use his rattle. His little drum and his rattle, he began to sing and ask God and the Creator and all the invisible forces. You know what? He said, this poor man didn't harm anybody. And by accident, he contracted his disease. You told me if I used the right medicine and the right thing, You helped me cure this man. I have now what you directed me to put on his belly. So take it out of him. And he sang with the man for 3 nights. And the fourth morning he woke up. And he said, okay, I'm going to go outside now. He said, this man hasn't eaten for a long time. He's dehydrated and he's weak. He'll wake up soon. Feed him. Oh, he's going to be all right. He said, I'm going to take this rock down by the river and thank the rock for healing him. So he took that rock, he put that rock, and the old medicine man went away. And about 3 hours later, the man woke up and was hungry and thirsty and weak, and they fed him and nursed him back to health. And about 2 months went by, and in the health service, doctor said, well, whatever happened to that man out there? Did he ever die? He said, no, he didn't die. He's healthy and he lived. He said, what do you mean healthy and lived? So they went out to look, and they found him playing lacrosse. And he was out there running around the field like everybody else. He couldn't be the same guy. They called him over, and they said, looked at him, and he said, it is the same. He said, how are you feeling? He said, I feel great. He said, well, what happened? He said, well, I don't know. He said, I got doctored. And the two doctors looked at each other, and he said, what do you mean you got doctored? Well, he said, Indian medicine man put a rock in my belly and sang to me, and he took it out of me. He said, you had incurable stomach cancer. I don't know what I had, he said, but it's gone. And the doctor said, rock? What rock? Get the rock! So they went down to the river, and he said, I think that flat one over there is what that old medicine man put down and put tobacco by, thanked the rock. So the doctors picked that rock up, and they took it back to the laboratory, and they chipped and sent pieces all over for examination and analysis. And they found out that rock was pure uranium, which later would be used for cobalt treatments to kill cancer cells. And that's how it was discovered. Discovered by an Indian medicine man. Now those two doctors, white doctors, they had a choice. Should we say it never happened? Should we say maybe we misdiagnosed? Should we say we picked the wrong guy? Maybe it was somebody else? And no. These white doctors were just like all of you could be, I said. You up-and-coming doctors. They wrote it down verbatim, exactly the way it happened. In the archives of our medical journals, that's how cobalt treatments were discovered. He was never given credit or even done that, but I said, that's the way it was. You look it up. It's in your medical history. Now that was a rock. Pure uranium with medicinal qualities. And I said, I want to let you guys know I have other stories and other things I want to bring you into the healing mechanism of our people and let you really know what healing is about. And I had their attention right now. All those 14 doctors, boy, I can't wait to get to this class. This guy's really something. And I'm really not anything. It was a story of my people and what they could do with the knowledge and the health and the skill of understanding the earth and what this earth has to offer us. And, you know, I think about all those things that we discovered. And about, I don't know, 30, maybe 40 years ago, we got together and started writing things that we contributed to United States Medical. And you'd be surprised. All that Native people committed and discovered before white people ever came here.
Larry Akin believes that Anishinaabe knowledge should not be kept secret, but rather shared with people, all people.
Our life, around our culture and our language and our history and our spiritual philosophy, is not staged for all time in some archival building or museum. It's meant to be used. And, you know, the worst thing we can do is put something away and only see it on celebratory occasions. Our stuff, our language, our history, our spirituality is to be used every single day. And preservation means that you save it until the time is right and then you use it. I don't think anything. I asked the old man, the medicine man, Jim Jackson. I said, is there anything we can't share? No, he said, I don't think so. There are things that people aren't ready to know yet. And there are things that if we share, we have to make, we have to guard safely against sharing that one item so they don't abuse it. But he said, one thing I need to say to the people, he said, is that everything we share with the white man, they either abuse it or use it for profit. And there are some things that are so sacred that we preserve until they're ready to use it, not for profit, but for the good of the order, for the good of the people, the good of the families, and good of the nation. Preservation is not holding it away, but preservation is finding a way to interpret and understand and get it out to the public so people can use it in their lives today. That's what preservation is about. It's not about hoarding it and hiding it and saying, you're not Indian enough to know this or not, whatever, you know. We get so defensive about it. And our language, our culture, our history, and our spiritual philosophy ought to be known and understood and used for the good of the public, good of the order, for good of the Indian families around this country.
As the interview with Larry Akin was coming to a close, I asked him if there is anything he wanted to say that I had not asked him. He most definitely had something on his mind, and he got a little choked up when he spoke.
And what I want you to know, and I want the public to know this, if you record this and nothing else, it'll be worth your while coming here, that you got women's suffrage in America. You never had in Europe. The predication of women being not only the right to vote, but the right to hold office, but the right to choose leaders. In the Iroquois Confederacy, the women chose the leaders who were to be the leaders, and they condoled them to be leaders. And women's suffrage was born out of that Iroquois Confederacy. And that's why women got a right to vote, and that's why women have standing in America now. It was an Indian thought and philosophy, not from Europe. It was from us. That's one of the things I want to come out. That women's suffrage came from Native people, because we know who the strongest of the sexes are. Women. Women are stronger than men. They always have been and they always will be. And all you men out there who think that's not true, the next time there's a baby in a family, you have it. You'll be laying on a table screaming or something for pain when women do this so natural. So you're not so strong after all. Also, women make better decisions than we do. We men make I, me, my decisions. Women make we, family decisions. They include everybody. And they're sent here to teach us to be men. And that comes from a man who didn't have a father. But because of my mother and the women I surrounded myself with, that surrounded me, gave me the strength to do and be what I was supposed to be. I owe it all to women. And I got married. My mother said to my wife, Polly, I brought a misfire. Take him the rest of the way. We have never, ever given women the respect and the thanks that they so immensely deserve. Every single person in this room came from woman. And when you die, you're going back to woman, Mother Earth. So it's time you thank your mothers, your wives, your sisters, your grandpa, I mean your grandmas, your aunties, and say thank you, women, for helping me be better. And women are selfless. And if women aren't there and aren't strong and straight and healthy, it's time they got strong, straight and healthy to build up this nation to be what we can be. Women are always the background in Indian country, building the leaders, teaching the leaders, supporting the leaders. And it was the other way around. If you think about it, in Western society, a male monk in the Dark Ages said women are the weaker sex. A male monk in the Dark Ages. Do we still believe that? The only thing women are good for is to have babies and stay in the nursery and cook for us? They watched us struggle. And finally, when they could not build the leaders to be what they're supposed to be, they took up the task too. But they know enough, women are so strong and so healthy and beautiful. They know enough to step back and not steal the men's limelight. They still are leaders. But they don't want to steal our show. They don't want to steal our shine because they're women. They are the ones that build the leaders. But sometimes they have to step up because we men don't lead like we ought to lead. And we have never ever said in America, in Indian country, we say it every day. Chimigwidj kwewug. Ginigwish chigan. Thank you for all you do, women, for us and our people. We owe it all to you. We have never said that, and it's about time we did. How many ever said, Mom, thank you for birthing me? It was a hard, powerful struggle. And when my mother was alive, I didn't fail to call her every single day she's alive and say, I love you. Thank you. When I could not stand up for myself, being a one-eyed Indian boy, she stood up for me. I didn't have a friend. She stood up for me. When I didn't think I could be anything, she said, I'll stand up for you. You'll be something. And I owe everything I have to my mom and my wife. They're the ones that deserve the credit, not me. I just worked hard to understand the culture, spirituality, and the phenomena of our language. And without their support, I would have quit a long time ago. So people ought to know that. You know, you ought to thank your wives and your mothers and your sisters. Before this day is over, you ought to say thank you to the women and say, I love you. We don't do that enough.
Larry Aiken of Cass Lake, Ojibwe man, college professor, elder, spiritual leader, father, and husband. Anishinaabe people believe that wolves, or Maingan in the Ojibwe language, are brothers to the people. This belief is based in tradition and on oral history, and that's a major reason why so many Minnesota and Wisconsin Anishinaabe are furious over the hunting of wolves, legalized just last year in both states. Some statistics. In Minnesota, the estimated population of wolves is just over 2,200. Last year, 413 were killed. The quota was 400. In Wisconsin, the estimated population is 815. Last year, 117 wolves were shot or trapped, 58% of the quota of 201. The 2013 season in Minnesota runs 77 days. It began this weekend, November 9th, and continues through January 31st, with Thanksgiving week not included. In Wisconsin, the season runs for 137 days, from October 15th to February 28th. The kill quota in Minnesota is 220. In Wisconsin, it's 275. Robert Shimmick is a native and environment activist. He is an elder of the White Earth Ojibwe Band in Minnesota, which last year outlawed the hunting of wolves on reservation land. To Robert, the killing of wolves carries a danger that goes beyond a person's belief system.
You know, where the thing really hits home for me is with the social structure within the packs. They're family units. They're highly socialized. You know, they have a mom and a dad. They have a alpha male and female, the ones who say to the kids, okay, here's how you live on this land. Here's how you take care of this land. Here's how you stay out of trouble. You know, here's how you pass the torch to the next generation. All those things are in that wolf pack. My thought is this. If we figure out what percentage of the alpha males and females are going to randomly get killed this year. You know, what I'm getting at is this. The vast majority of the wolf packs in the state of Minnesota have learned how to be here and stay out of trouble. There are some who haven't. You know, and we always hear about them. But the biggest share of them are not problematic. They know how to stay out of the farmer's cattle or sheep or goats or chickens or whatever. They just, you know, they've learned how to do that. So if you destabilize that social order within these wolf packs by, you know, random killing of the alpha males or females or both, in essence, what you've done is left the leadership up to a bunch of teenagers. I mean, I raised teenagers. I know how that goes. You know, when you leave them home alone, unattended, stuff happens. So, you know, what happens when the alphas don't come back? We could dramatically affect that balance now with the random killing of the alpha males and females. And I believe we could find ourselves in a situation in a few short years with people clamoring again to get rid of all of the wolves in the state because they're just too damn much trouble because we've destroyed the social order. It was really not a whole lot different than what they did to Indians back in the 18 and early 1900s. You know, a lot of our leadership, a lot of our medicine people, our spiritual people, our smart people, our wise ones, our history keepers, you know, they sent them off to insane asylums. You know, when our children were sent to boarding schools, re-educated in the ways of the white man, you know, what did that do to our social order? So we've been there. We've gone through all this together. Anishinaabe, Gaye, Mayinkin. What happens to one happens to another. And I feel if we do not safeguard Mayingan now, you know, our future is pretty bleak as well.
Robert Chimick of White Earth. You have been listening to Teachings from Turtle Island, Stories of Anishinaabe People. Teachings from Turtle Island is a production of Northern Community Radio and supported by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. White Earth Elder Mary Favorite consulted on and co-produced Teachings from Turtle Island. This is Brian Whittemore.